So it's a pleasure to be here. I would like to just spend some time sharing with you the experiences that I had in in March of 1965, related to the voting rights campaign that was taking place in Selma, Alabama, just prior to the march from Selma to Montgomery. I was then the rabbi of Congregation Beth Israel in Berkeley, California. My wife and I had been living in Berkeley since 1963. Early March of 1965, the Board of Rabbis of Northern California...
Maybe use the mic, I think you're running.
Can't hear me back there? That's better? Okay. In early March of 1965, the Board of Rabbis of Northern California received a call. One of the members of the Board of Rabbis of Northern California, which was a board of Orthodox Conservative and Reform rabbis and Reconstruction rabbis, received a call from Martin Luther King asking them to see whether there were rabbis in Northern California who would be willing to come to Selma to participate in voter rights campaigning and then possibly participate in the march from Selma to Montgomery. No one at that point knew how many people were going to appear, and certainly no one knew how many people would be able to march. The reality was that Martin Luther King Jr. was then negotiating with President Johnson around the question of assuring federal protection for the marchers. President Johnson was reluctant to ship too many soldiers into the area, and therefore wanted the numbers of people who would march from Selma to Montgomery to be reduced so that they would be able to be assured that the federal forces would be able to protect everyone. But nevertheless, Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was deeply committed to getting as many clergy as possible into the area. The board was also contacted by SNCC asking the same question to see if rabbis would be willing to come to participate, because they were, of course, much more involved on the ground in the voter registration campaigns than SCLC. SCLC was much more involved with the plans for the march. Even there was lots of overlap, lots of competition between the various black organizations who were then involved in these civil rights efforts. The Board of Rabbis circulated the question to all of its members. There were five of us in Northern California who indicated that we would be willing to go to Selma at that time. The decision to go to Selma was not simple at that point in time, for numbers of reasons, not least of which was the history of violence related to voting rights campaigns in the South. That violence had already begun in the mid-1950s. Voter registration drives had resulted in murders already in 1955. Reverend George Lee was killed. There were a number of others who were killed in all through the 1950s. The history of voter registration campaigns leading to death of the people who were involved in those efforts had been relatively constant from 1955 through this period of time till 1965. Violence generally related to civil rights efforts had intensified beginning really in 1962 and 1963. It was in 1963 that Medgar Evers was assassinated, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham took place, during which this group of children between the ages of 11 and 14 were killed. Those of you who saw it, how many of you saw the movie Selma? Okay, so much that I will say will you will have resonance of. Right, my wife and I, before we went to see the movie, had engaged in a debate around the question of which violent scene would the movie open with. And we sort of felt that it would probably open with the killing of Jimmie Lee Jackson. That actually didn't appear until later in the film, but the opening scene was the bombing that took place in the Birmingham church. And the killings, the violence that was taking place did not stop with that, with that bombing, despite all sorts of efforts to stop it. It really did not stop, right? As you all know, in June of 1964, Cheney and Goodman and Schwerner were killed. It was not until 2004 that the people who, or the one surviving person who participated in those murders, was brought to trial and convicted. In February of 1965, Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed. I'll tell you some more about that for a particular reason that has to do with my own experience. And just a week before I arrived in Selma, Reverend James Reeb was killed. So the level of violence associated with these voter rights campaigns. Beyond that, of course, the distinctive level of violence that had been manifested in the attempt to stop the first attempt at the march from Selma to Montgomery, would of necessity give one pause. For me, there was another totally unrelated element of pause involved, and that is that the week before the planned march was also the week of Tanis Esther and Purim. And so it would, deciding to participate would mean that I would not be with my shul over the Chag of Purim. My wife and I discussed the question of whether I should go or not, and decided that I would go. We also decided that since she was going to be in New York later that same week that I would be in Selma, that we would not inform my parents, who at that point in time still lived in Bed-Stuy, where I had grown up. My father was sort of the last rav in that neighborhood, managed to keep his shul going long beyond the general sort of transformation of that piece of Bed-Stuy from a mixed neighborhood of Jews, Irish, and Italians, to all black. We were had for a very long time, by that time, been the last white family living on our block. And my father was really quite safe, though, walking through the streets, because as our neighbors informed him, all of the black ministers in the neighborhood had warned their teenage kids that if they start up with the old rabbi, that they will burn in hell unto all of eternity. So my father was able to, walk through the streets, and the gangs would sort of part and allow him to go through. It was not quite that safe for anybody else by that time. In any case, so I left from Northern California with a group of four other rabbis, one conservative rabbi, and three reform rabbis, and myself, and I left a message to be read to the congregation on the night of Purim, because I wanted the congregation to understand that my motivation in going to Selma at that point was not driven by my liberal politics. My politics were not quite as liberal then as they subsequently became, but that was really driven by my own sense of Jewish conscience. And the message that I left them was a very short Dvar Torah built around the beginning of Sefer Shmot. And it raised the question of whether the Torah tells us why HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose Moshe to be the person who would redeem Am Yisrael from Mitzrayim. To which my answer was that the Torah tells us precisely, in fact, in approximately 7 psukim, the stretch of approximately 7 psukim, the Torah tells us exactly why HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose Moshe to take the Israel out of Mitzrayim and to give them, and to be the medium through which the Torah will be delivered to Am Yisrael. And that it is contained in that very short sequence of 3 narratives, approximately 2-3 psukim each, right? The first of which is that Moshe saw a Jew being struck by an Egyptian, and Moshe intervened, and so there was no one else who would intervene, and so he struck and killed the Egyptian and hid the body in the sand. Right? That whole story takes place just in 2 or 3 sentences. It's the whole thing. And then immediately we're told about a second story, right, where Moshe sees one Jew fighting with another Jew, and he criticizes one of them by saying, "Rasha Lamatakariyaha, why are you threatening to strike your neighbor?" And in consequence of that intervention, right, because the Jew, you know, the Jew talks back, the Jew said back to Moshe, "Right, are you going to kill me the way you killed the Egyptian?" And Moshe is then aware that the news is out, and that therefore his life would be at risk, and therefore Moshe leaves. And there's no gap there, right? The Midrash fills in the gap between the end of that story and maybe 40 years later or whatever period of time it was, when Moshe finds himself in the deserts of Midian, right? And there in the desert of Midian, Moshe comes upon yet another scene of injustice. And one would reasonably have assumed that as Moshe sees these other shepherds attempting to prevent the daughters of Yisro from watering their flocks, one would assume that Moshe must have had some sort of a malach sitting on his shoulder, tugging at the corner of his ear, saying, "Meshela, listen, you know why you're no longer a prince of Egypt, and instead you're a wanderer in the deserts of Midian? You know why that is? That's because you stuck your nose in everybody else's business. So, and here you have no connection to anybody. It's not an Egyptian beating a Jew. It's not 2 Jews fighting. Right? These are people you have no relationship to whatsoever. So enough already. Stay out of it. Keep your nose out of this business." Right? And Moshe is unwilling to do that. Moshe insists that in the face of that injustice, he has to intervene to rescue these people. And I think what the Torah is telling us there is something extraordinarily important about the qualities that need to be manifested in Am Yisrael, not only in Moshe as leader, but in Am Yisrael as a whole, and that those qualities in turn get translated into the legal requirements that embody the laws of Torah, that are embodied in the laws of Torah. In any case, I wanted people to understand that my sense of responsibility in relation to this issue that the nation was dealing with really was derived from that sense of responsibility. In any case, we arrived in Montgomery, and there we were separated. That is, the 5 of us were separated. One other rabbi and I were in one particular car for the ride from Montgomery to Selma. Cars driving the road from Montgomery to Selma, which contained whites and blacks, only drove in caravans. They drove only in caravans because the most likely circumstance that people would meet up with if there was a car during this period of time, because it was particularly a period when there were lots of people coming in to the area to engage in demonstrations and as well to engage in voter rights efforts. And when cars containing both whites and blacks were riding along that road, very often they would suddenly find themselves sandwiched between 2 other cars, forced to come to a stop. The doors of the car opened, the passengers dragged out, beaten, and left on the side of the road. And therefore, in order to protect people in that trip, The cars traveled only in caravans of between 7 and 10 cars consecutively, which reduced the likelihood of people being subject to violence. The person who was the driver of the car, that I and one colleague, and there were a few other people in the car, the driver of that car turned out to be an uncle of Jimmy Lee Jackson. And while we had heard that Jimmy Lee Jackson had been killed, there were lots of details about that story that had not yet been widely known, and he told us the story of the death of Jimmy Lee Jackson, which had just taken place only weeks before. So those of you who saw the movie will remember the sort of the outline of the story. Really very simple and straightforward. There was a demonstration, a civil rights demonstration. Jimmy Lee Jackson was together with his mother and his grandfather. They were participants in the demonstration. The demonstration was broken up by state troopers. The state troopers were the most violent of all of the police forces that were then active in that area of the South. The Selma police were not nearly as violent. They were not pussycats, but they did not use their weapons for themselves in the same way that the state troopers did. The state troopers broke up this particular demonstration. Many of the people who were participants in the demonstration just fled in all directions. Jimmy Lee Jackson and his mother and grandfather fled. They thought that they had found shelter in a small restaurant. Didn't know that they were being chased, actually, being tracked. And a number of troopers came into the restaurant, saw them sitting at a table, grabbed Jimmy Lee Jackson's mother, threw her to the ground, and one of the officers started beating her with his truncheon. Jimmy Lee Jackson had some training in passive resistance, and so he knew that the worst thing he could do is attack the police officers, and instead what he did is he threw himself over his mother's body to protect her. Right, so he threw himself down so over her body to protect her. The police officer was infuriated at this interference with his administration of justice, and he took his gun and he held it to Jimmy Lee Jackson's back and he said, "Get off or I'll shoot you." Jimmy Lee Jackson refused to move. The officer shot him and with his foot rolled Jimmy Lee Jackson off his mother. The fact is that that officer then subsequently filed charges against Jimmy Jackson for interference with the administration of justice. Meanwhile, Jimmy Jackson is now has a bullet in his back, lying there on the ground, bleeding, clearly mortally wounded. The two officers who were in the restaurant at that moment in time began arguing over whether they should call an ambulance or not. They spent 10 to 15 minutes arguing about that particular question. Finally, they decided that they might get into trouble if they didn't call an ambulance, and so they called for an ambulance, and they specifically informed the ambulance that there was a black who had been shot by an officer who needed help. And so the ambulance arrived approximately half an hour later. The emergency medical technicians came out of the ambulance into the restaurant. They checked Jimmy Lee Jackson over, and they then debated the question of whether it paid to bring him into the hospital or not. They too decided that they would get into trouble if he was still alive. They would get into trouble if they didn't bring him in, and so they loaded him on a stretcher and they put him into the ambulance and they started driving to the hospital at normal city speeds, stopping at every stoplight and every stop sign. By the time they got to the hospital, it was too late for him to be saved, and soon thereafter, he died. So this, and there are many other details of the story that he told us at the time, but this was sort of clear that this was what the black community was experiencing as a norm in the level of violence that was being utilized at that point in time. We got to Selma, And we were dropped at Brown's Chapel, which was then the central location for all of the black organizations who were working on the various civil rights issues. There were about 10 different desks, one for each of the organizations. They were, as those of you who sort of have awareness of that know, that there was enormous competition and a lot of conflict amongst the variety of black organizations. It made us feel very much at home. Right there in the midst of a Jewish scene. All these black defense organizations fighting over who should be doing what and whose work was more important than everybody else's. And a lot of resentment of Martin Luther King because in the churches, Martin Luther King was Moses. Because the central metaphor that the black churches, the black ministers were using for the description of the battle that the black community was engaged in at the time was the Exodus. The biblical resonance in all of this was quite extraordinary. And, for those ministers talking about the Exodus and teaching the Exodus, and that this was the Exodus of the black community of the United States, and that the Moses figure was Martin Luther King. And most of the other black leaders were deeply resentful of that ascription of grandeur to Martin Luther King. But nevertheless, they all had achieved some level of cooperation. So that, for example, at that point in time, just prior to our departure, our small group's departure from Northern California to Selma, we had gotten a call from SNCC asking us to please bring boxes of black silk kippot. So we asked, and the rabbi got the call, what do you need these kippot for? And what do you need? They didn't call them kippot, they were yarmulkes. What do you need them for? And they said, huge numbers of blacks, and the practice was started by numbers of black clergymen, are now wearing kippot as freedom caps, and are identifying them as freedom caps. The practice was begun by a number of black clergymen, one of whom described the reason that he started this practice in the following way. He said, when the troopers see me, they see a black. When they see this yarmulke on my head, they wonder, maybe they're making a mistake, and maybe I'm not really black, because maybe I'm Jewish. And therefore, they treat me better, he said. And so in consequence of that, and there was, at that point in time, in 1965, there had already been some strain, particularly in SNCC and CORE and some of the other black groups, not so much in SCLC, but there had already been some strain between Jews engaged in civil rights between the organized Jewish community and the black efforts. Those tensions became much stronger later on. But there had already been some. But nevertheless, the general attitude toward Jewish involvement in civil rights on the part of black leaders was dominantly positive. And the notion that this was sort of a biblically framed effort that the black community was involved in was a very powerful awareness. So we got to Brown's Chapel and dropped our knapsacks. They told us that we would be sleeping over at various families. We were being farmed out to various families all through Selma. But that before we went to those families, they wanted us to have some training in passive resistance. But before we could get to the training in passive resistance, another call came for people to join a demonstration that would take place in front of the home of Mayor Smitherman, Mayor Joseph Smitherman had just the preceding year, in 1964, been elected as mayor of Selma. He's a young man, and there were lots of people in the black community who believed that he would be much more open and much more accessible and much more willing to negotiate with the black community about improvements, particularly in issues of voter registration and in education in the community. And they were making sincere attempts to try to get to him and to work with him. They were not getting any place, not getting very far. Mayor Smitherman, by the way, remained the mayor of Selma until when? Until September 2000. Right, from 1964, he was elected, he remained mayor of Selma until September 2000. In any case, they wanted to have a demonstration in front of Mayor Smitherman's home. And so they asked people to join in this effort for this demonstration. And so this other rabbi, my colleague, and I said, okay, you know, we'll go with this. There were a group of about 120 people. They knew that they couldn't march 120 people into the white neighborhood. Not only the troopers, but the local Selma police had been working very hard to keep the white neighborhoods quiet. And to make sure that with all of the turmoil that was going around, that the white residential neighborhoods would remain quiet. And therefore, there was actually a town ordinance which did not allow public demonstrations in white neighborhoods. That's the way it was written in the ordinance. And so we knew we couldn't just march into the neighborhood. And so what they did essentially is they gave us maps and they spread us out. They dropped us off at a broad spectrum of streets, and three people at a time would go marching in, you know, this street and that street and that street and this street, and all of us aimed at the same location, and then we regrouped quite suddenly in front of Mayor Smitherman's home, and then sort of unfurled posters and began to sing and to call for Mayor Smitherman to really enter into serious negotiation with the leadership of the black community in Selma. Within about 10 minutes after our arrival there, the police arrived. And they announced that we were in violation of this local ordinance and that we had to disband immediately or they would put us all under arrest. We had been told that this is what would probably happen and that the group did not intend to disband, so that everybody who came in at the outset understood that the likelihood was that everybody would be arrested. That's exactly what happened. They had brought buses in and they loaded us onto buses and told us they were taking us into the police station to be booked. So they loaded us on the buses, about 40 or so people on each bus. There were three police officers on each bus, one in the back, one in the middle, and one in the front. They announced that there would be no speaking whatsoever, nobody could talk at all during this short trip that we would take to the police station. So I was sitting, sort of a lonely aisle, right around here, sitting sort of in the middle of the bus. One police officer was standing sort of right around here. The young man looked perfectly reasonable, perfectly normal, the bus was really quiet. And so I sort of turned to him, and I sort of leaned my neck up toward him, and I said, I'm sure that you really don't want to be doing this. So he, without even pausing, said, I'm very sure building, so I can't say everything that he said, but he said effectively, I would rather kill you and burn in hell than to have to listen to your expletives omitted. And he then took his truncheon and he swung. Now, I'm sure that had he wanted to, he could have really done very severe damage to me at the time. He missed my ear and I felt the wind of the stick going right by my ear, and which then smashed into the back of the seat in front of me,
indenting the seat and bouncing that person forward. The bus got very quiet, really quiet or anything after that.
They took us on the buses to the police station, and there was not enough room for us in the cells, and so they put us into a court. And it wasn't quite a courtroom; it was more like an auditorium that was like a holding area. And they told us that we'll stay there until they took us. There were no chairs in the room. There were no benches. There was floor and walls. So that day, that Wednesday, was the 13th of Adar. And so I had been fasting since that morning, actually since the night before. I was thirsty and I was hungry, but there was nothing to do. They were not giving us anything to drink. They were not giving us anything to eat either. I was wondering how long it would be before I'd be able to get something to eat. But that was the condition we were in. Everybody was sort of sitting around. People were getting to know each other. People were talking to each other. As I said, there were about 120 people there, of whom, you know, maybe 30 of them were clergy, and the others were, majority of the others were white young people who were graduate students and undergraduate students and young professionals who had come to Selma in order to help in voter registration campaigns. And with the expectation that they would be able to participate in the march from Selma to Montgomery. And then there were about 40 or so young blacks, local blacks, who were in the group. So we were there, and as I said, just sitting around and talking, wondering when they were going to book us. And then suddenly a police officer walks into the hall, and he calls out from there, the doorways, is there a Rabbi Berman here? So I was not anxious to identify myself. So I just sort of sat there and didn't say anything. And so he started sort of weaving his way amongst the various people sitting there. And then he saw me. I was much younger. I already had a beard, but it was black. And I was wearing a kippah, but I was not wearing one of the silk ones. I was wearing this black, black woolen ones. And whatever, he pickled at me and he said, "Are you Rabbi Berman?" So I was not ready to deny that to his face. So I said, "No, yes." He said, "Okay, you come with me." So, not knowing what I was headed for, I sort of started following him toward the door. So now back up a little. As I said, the five rabbis, the five of us who came from Northern California, two of us were in this car, right? The other three were delayed, and they didn't come in until later. By the time they got into Selma, they asked where we were, and they were told that we had been arrested and that we were in prison. So one of the three realized that I would be fasting and that I would not have any food, and he was doubtful that there would be any kosher food around that anybody would be able to give me. And so it occurred to him that I might have food in my bag. So he was able to track down my bag in someone's home, and he opened up my bag, and there, sure enough, he found a paper bag with a tubular object in it, which was in fact a salami. But there was another tubular object there, which was a small Megillah, which my father's Megillah, which I had taken along with me. So he took both of those tubes. And sort of in total oblivion to what he was doing, set out from Brown's Chapel to go to the prison, carrying these two tubular objects under his arms like this, attracting a lot of attention, but nothing particularly strong until he got very close to the police station when he was jumped by a group of officers, fearful that he was carrying weapons. And then he was trying to convince them that they were not weapons, it was a salami and a scroll. He managed to explain to them, you know, why he was carrying these things, and they agreed. They actually called the police chief in to consult on this one, whether they could, you know, give these to me. And he said yes, that they could. And so when I came out, I found my colleague there with the salami and the nihilim. So I went back inside. They brought me back inside and back into the room. And there were in the group, there was myself and my colleague and from Northern California, and there were a number of other rabbis who were present, and I told them that I now had a Megillah. We could read Megillat Esther. And so the decision was made that we would do a public reading of Megillat Esther, so with Tirgum, with translation. They would not agree to read the whole thing, but we would sort of read selections, and then I could go off and read the whole thing myself, which is what we did. It turned out that of the young white people who had come in from all over the country, the majority of them were Jewish. Most of them had not heard of Purim. Almost none of them knew what Megillah was. Now, the truth is that we did not know at that point in time, and I didn't know until weeks later, that at Jimmie Lee Jackson's funeral, one of the black ministers called on the poor whites in the South to come to the aid of poor blacks. And he said the following. He said, "Let me read you the following verse." And guess what he read? He read what Mordechai said to Esther. "Al tadami ben hasheikh. Don't think for a moment that you will be able to be protected if the rest of the Jews are under threat." Right? If you don't help, if you don't stand up on behalf of the Jewish people, then the Jewish people will nevertheless be saved by God. But you and your household will die. And then, using that verse, he said, "Let me tell you, poor whites, our compatriots here in the South. You think that it's only us from whom they're going to take away the right to vote? You think we're the only ones who will be denied economic opportunity? You think we're the only ones who will be denied decent educations? If they can get away with doing that to us, they'll do it to you also." So at the time, I did not know. As I said, we didn't know that that verse was being, you know, had been used in that way. But we read selections from the Megillah. I then went off into a corner with one other colleague, and we read the whole Megillah, and then was able to have some salami and share that. It was a little difficult. They didn't give us a knife. For some reason, they wouldn't give us a knife. In any case, but they did eventually give us water, and so I was able to have some of the break fast. Meanwhile, then, you know, that also broke the ice in the group as a whole, and that sort of generated a lot of discussion in the group. Meanwhile, so there was more conversation and more discussion going on, and then later that evening, we were still waiting to be booked. Later that evening, an officer comes into the room, and he says, "Is there a Rabbi Joseph Gumbiner here?" So I knew that Rabbi Joseph Gumbiner was there, because he was sitting right next to me. He was my colleague from Berkeley. He was a Hillel rabbi
in Berkeley at UC Berkeley. And I knew him very well. In fact, I was very indebted to him because it was because of him that my shul was founded. I'll tell you about that in a minute. So the name Gumbiner is familiar to you, right? Who's Gumbiner? Magen Avraham. Right? Rabbi Avraham Gumbiner. Rabbi Avraham Gumbiner. Rabbi Avraham. Right? I mean, you study Shulchan Aruch and you learn Magen Avraham. So, you know, this Rabbi Joseph Gumbiner was a direct, right, that Magen Avraham lived in the 1600s, right? He was a direct descendant on the male line from the Magen Avraham. He was a reform rabbi who had a deep and abiding hatred of Orthodoxy. And he was so discomforted by the small Orthodox meaning in the Hillel building that he drove them out. Literally. He said they couldn't daven in the Hillel building. And so they had to find a place to daven. And so they found some place about a mile south of the campus in Berkeley. And it was being used at that time. It was a building that was being used at that time as sort of a senior center. It was called Berkeley Hebrew Center. And they, this group of young graduate students and faculty asked the people at the Berkeley Hebrew Center if they would allow them to daven their Shabbos morning, to which the response of the older people was, as long as it doesn't interfere with our car play, it's fine. And that was the origin of my shul. 2 years later, I became the rabbi of that shul. So I knew Rabbi Gumbiner very well. He was sitting right next to me, and he was not fessing up. Despite the fact that I ended up with a Megillah and a Salam, and he was not going to trust that he would end up with the same thing. So he's not fessing up. So the officer is sort of wandering around the room, and he saw me, he recognized me, and he saw this other gentleman sitting next to me. He says, are you Rabbi? He was not wearing a kippah. Are you Rabbi Gumbiner? He said, yes. So the officer said, okay, you come with me. So he said, I'm not going alone. So the officer said, well, you're coming. So, you know, get yourself up. He didn't say it quite as nicely as that. But, you know, get your whatever up off the floor and you know, come with me. So he said, no, I'm not going to go alone. So I was sitting next to him. So I said, okay, I'll go with you. And then the fellow who was sitting on the other side of him said, okay, I'll go with you also. So the three of us went out. Right, Rabbi Gumbiner and the two others went out. So why were they calling Rabbi Gumbiner out? Rabbi Gumbiner had failed to let any of us know that some 25 years earlier, when he was ordained at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, that his first pulpit placement was in the Reform congregation in Selma, Alabama. And there he had been for 4.5 to 5 years as the rabbi of the community in Selma, Alabama. Now, while they had not yet booked us, they had asked us for our names, and they had sort of made a list of the names of all of the people who had been arrested this time. And amongst them was, and he had said rabbi before his name, so they had this, rabbi, Joseph Gumbiner. And somebody mentioned it to a member of the Jewish community that evening, that there was a rabbi, Joseph Gumbiner, who was arrested. And it rang a bell. And so what was happening right now was that there was a delegation of three people from the Jewish community, from the Reform Temple in Selma, who had asked to meet with us. And so they gave us a small interrogation room with a table in it and like six chairs, and we sat there. And there was some small talk. Oh, you're right. One of the three people was actually there at the time that Rabbi Gumbiner was there. Remembered him. They had family associations and stuff like that, and made small talk for a while. And then the delegation from the Jewish community essentially said to us as follows. They said, it is really urgent for you people to leave. All of you rabbis, to pack up your stuff and leave Selma.
immediately. Why? Because they said, first of all, you know, like, we are not a wealthy community here. We all have small businesses. It's retail. The black community in this entire area in Alabama had already initiated a boycott against all white-owned stores, as a result of which we have already lost an enormous amount of our significant percentage of our business because of that. But because there are so many rabbis and so many Jews around who have come to help the blacks, and so many people wearing kippot, even if they're not Jewish, as if they were Jewish, our white Christian neighbors are holding us responsible for all of this turmoil, all of this antagonism, and for the disruption of their way of life. And therefore now, even our white Christian neighbors are not buying from us. So we're desperate now. So you have to get out of here. So we sort of heard them out. You know, we were asking them a variety of questions. And then, to make a very long story short, I mean, our response to them essentially was as follows. Now, 1965, we said to them, 20 years after the Holocaust, during these 20 years, we have been telling European Christians that the Holocaust was not just the fault of Hitler, not just the fault of the SS or the Nazi Party, not even just the fault of the collaborators in the various countries in which Jews were handed over to the Nazis, but that all of those Christian citizens who remained silent in the early stages of the attacks against Jews, who then said, this has nothing to do with us, because they're not attacking us, they're not appropriating our property, they're not preventing our children from going to schools, they're not preventing us from practicing our professions. And when the Pope, in the early stages of the rise of Nazism in Germany, when Pope Pius XII said, no, he would not speak out publicly in an attempt to protect the Jews, because that would ruin the social and economic position of Catholics. It would endanger Catholics by ruining their social and economic position in all of these countries. We've been telling all of these people for 20 years that they share in the guilt, that they share in the responsibility of what happened to the Jewish people over the course of the years of the Holocaust. So what exactly do you want us to tell them now? That it's only when Christians are silent, when Jews are being attacked, that there's any guilt for the failure to speak out? But that when, because that's motivated by the desire to protect the social and economic conditions of Christians, then that's wrong, but that when Jews remain silent in order to protect the social and economic conditions of other Jews, when others are being deprived of their rights, that that's the right thing to do? Really, is that what you would like us to be telling the people of Poland, Hungary, and all the other European countries in which that was happening? We said, listen, we understand the plight that you're in, and we are willing to undertake a responsibility to do everything that we can to get Jewish organizations and the Jewish community from all over the country and, if necessary, from all over the world to provide the economic resources so that if you really have to leave here because the social and economic conditions are intolerable, that at least you'll have the resources to settle someplace else. But we can't just walk away from the enormity of the injustices
that are occurring here, they were not persuaded. On the other hand, neither were we.
And so the debate continued for a very long time, and we parted after hours, no one being happy.
We were certainly not happy with the sort of plight that we were in,
but we couldn't see our way clear to leaving or to encouraging others to leave. I don't know to what extent they were willing to understand the position that we were taking, but they certainly knew that we were not going to leave, and so they were unhappy. By the next morning, by Thursday morning, the police chief had decided that he was going to release us without booking us. And so we were all loaded off the buses on Thursday morning, driven back to Brown's Chapel, and there released. Why he released us, he didn't say anything about it then, but you'll hear more about that a little bit later on. So on Thursday, there were continuing efforts at voter registration. I went with numbers of blacks into the, those of you who saw Selma, remember that great scene with Oprah, right, trying to register to vote, right, and having known that she wasn't Oprah in the movie, it was just a, middle-aged black woman trying to register to vote, and knowing that the voting registrar was going to ask her all sorts of questions that would be impossible for her to answer in order to be able to deny her the right to register. And so this guy is asking her questions, all sorts of questions about the Constitution, about American history, about the order of presidents, and all sorts of stuff. And she's got the answer to every single question. And at the point that she has run out of questions, he pulls down the window of the booth and he says, "Sorry, I have to close now," and refuses to register. We saw that happen over and over again. The reality was that they didn't really need any excuses in the final benefit. Often made excuses in order to have some kind of cover, but the reality was that they were simply going to deny the opportunity to register to vote to any blacks who came into the city hall in order to attempt to register. During the course of that, I had walked through the white neighborhoods a number of times, both accompanying people to the city hall, as well as on one occasion to go back to Mayor Smitherman's home to deliver a letter to Mayor Smitherman from one of the organizations. So it was Thursday. was a busy day. We slept in the home of a black family in Selma. The next morning, on Friday morning, went back to Brown's Chapel, and there were able to begin to participate in further activities related to voter registration until the early afternoon on Friday, when a call went out again for a major demonstration in front of the city hall in Selma. And again, people would drop off at various points, we wouldn't all walk in together, but we ended up approximately 240 or so people standing in front of the city hall, with placards and singing and making noise. And same thing, about 15 minutes later, the police were there, lineup of buses, telling us we had to desist and leave the area immediately or we'd be put under arrest. We said we're not going. They loaded us into the buses and took us to actually a different location, which was actually a courthouse, which was connected to the police station on the other side. And they put us also into a large auditorium-type room, no chairs, and they actually kept us standing outside for a couple of hours before they brought us inside. No bathroom facilities, no water to drink, nothing. And then they brought us inside, and everybody was sitting around. it got to be, you know, close to Shkia time, and so I got mincha, and then talking with a number of the other rabbis present, we decided that we should do some kind of a Kabbalat Shabbat service. Once again, our experience was that well over 50% of the young whites present were Jewish. And at that point, I recall the teaching that I had heard in the name of Rav Kook. I never really identified where it is, but the teaching that I had heard in the name of Rav Kook, who had spoken about the proposition that there are two different forms of rebellion against Torah. There's chutzpah tator and chutzpah ilama. Said Rav Kook, chutzpah tator, so the lower form of chutzpah, is a rebellion against Torah which is motivated by a person's inability to exercise self-restraint in the presence of the opportunity for pleasure. Right? So one wants to have a particular experience, a pleasurable experience. Now, Allah says you're not allowed to do that. The Torah says you're not allowed to do that. So the individual says, nah, so what? That the Torah said, I want to do that. I'm going to do it anyway. So that, says Rav Kook, is a lower form of rebellion against Torah. And that, you know, the person has to assume some responsibility. The person who engages in that kind of rebellion against Torah needs to assume a substantial amount of responsibility because they're acting wrongfully, irresponsibly. Every human being has to have the capacity to constrain themselves and to sort of deny themselves pleasures that are not consistent with the fundamental values that they need to adhere to. On the other hand, he said, there is chutzpah law. What is chutzpah law? He said, people whose rebellion against Torah is not motivated by their desire for pleasure, but is motivated by their search, for spirituality and ethics. And those people who are motivated by the desire for spirituality and ethics, who are unable to find that in Yadus, said Rav Kook, that's not entirely their fault. That's substantially our fault. Because if we, the teachers of Torah, have not been able to present Torah in a way that enables people to understand that the highest possible forms of spirituality and ethics can be achieved precisely through Torah, then we have failed in teaching Torah. We're not teaching Torah correctly. And that we can't blame entirely on them. We have to share in the blame for that. That's chutzpah ilah, he said. It's a higher form of rebellion. In any case, that's what we were sort of seeing there for many of these young people. In any case, we did Kabbalat Shabbat service. And you know, tried to explain the connections that we felt were present between the ethics of Shabbat and the ethics of civil rights, and then a few of us went off into a corner and actually got in a little bit of a Torah Shabbat and married. We didn't have any wine, but we could say the Brachim Kadesh Shabbat and certainly fulfilled the rest of Zohar Shabbat Shabbat Shom. Didn't have any food there to eat. In any case, this is what we were, you know, doing. There was a lot of conversation. It was a very talkative group, and so there were a lot of people talking with each other. And a lot of conversation about Jewish matters, about Jewish values. And then the police chief, Winston, came into the room and said he wants all the clergy to come out. There are about 50 of us who are clergy in this group, and we sort of came out of the room, and he took us into a smaller space. He sat us down, and he said the following to us. He said, I understand that you people are really well motivated. You really want to help the blacks in Selma, right? I understand that. He said, it's an admirable motivation, he said. But then you have to understand what the reality is. You see, we have now arrested all of you. And we can book all of you. And amongst you, there are possibly 40 young people who are local people
right here from Sullivan. Flats from Sullivan. If we book you, and if we book them, then everything that you think about your help for them is going to go right down the drain. Because if they are booked here and charged with the commission of a crime here in Selma, there is not a southern community in this area in which those people will ever be able to get a job. They will never be trained by any whites in this entire area to do any kind of work that would enable them to have a trade. And if they need any kind of government help for anything, they ain't not gonna get it. And so if you think that you're hanging out with them here and you're protesting here is gonna help them, then while I understand that you are well motivated, you are mistaken. In fact, your presence here is going to destroy the rest of their lives. Now, so I'm going to make you an offer that you better not refuse, he said. If you all agree that you will now leave and that you will pack up and leave Selma and leave the area and go back home where you came from, then I will agree to allow you to go without booking you, and I will also not book our local people. But if you insist on staying here, I'll book them, and you'll be responsible for the detriments to them for the rest of their lives. So, we said, you know, it's interesting, we need to think about that, we need to talk about it, and we'll let you know. So he said, okay, let the officers know when you're ready to give me an answer. So we, the 50 of us, sort of filed back into this large room. We took over one corner of the room and began to engage in a serious discussion about, you know, what this really meant and what this would mean to these young people for whom we might now have some kind of responsibility. So then an interesting thing happened. Obviously, the room is not even this large. Everybody was just sitting around. It did not take long for people to begin to realize what it was that we were talking about back there in that corner. So for the young white people who had come, as I said, from all over the country to be helpful, to them it seemed perfectly natural that we the clergy should sit there off in the corner, that we should discuss this, come to a decision, and let the chief of police know what we decided. On the other hand, for these 40 or so young black people who were sitting in the room, when they became aware of what it was that we were discussing, it did not seem to them at all reasonable for us to be sitting there alone, talking about this and thinking that we had the right to make that decision. And they then became very vocal about that. And they said, wait a second, right? Yes, it's true, we understand, we appreciate the fact that you've come here to help us. But don't you think that the decision about what is most beneficial for us, that in that decision, don't you think that we're entitled to have a voice in it? You think that you guys have the right to make that decision independently of us without even asking us about that? I mean, it's our lives, it's our futures that are at stake. So you've got to include us in this conversation. You can't make those decisions yourselves. I mean, they used some harsher language than that in that early part of the conversation, but that was the gist of what they were saying. I mean, they spoke in terms of being simply a further attempt at white colonization of blacks. Right? I mean, this was not fundamentally different from their perspective than what the white community in the whole of the South was doing to them. Right? Treating them as subhuman, incapable of making judgments, incapable of leading their own lives freely, incapable of making their own choices. Right? I mean, that was sort of the
In any case, so relatively rapidly, a decision was made that we needed to open this conversation to everybody present, with everybody agreeing that at the end of the conversation, when we decided the conversation was completed, that we would take a vote, and that everybody would abide by the majority vote. So there were some people who did not want to agree to that, but so it took a while to get that to be settled, but then that decision was made. And what then began was a conversation that really made me feel as if I was back in base village. It was just quite extraordinary. The level of debate that emerged, the alternative positions, the challenging of positions, the inability of that large group to conduct a single discussion and the need to break up into smaller groups and sort of thrash through certain kinds of issues and look at certain kinds of effects and then come back and discuss the whole thing. And after many hours of discussion and debate, a vote was taken, and the vote was overwhelmingly that we all stay. And so we called in a police officer, told him that we needed to have a word with Chief of Police Wilson. By that time, it must have been 1 or 2 in the morning. But he had left instructions, he was to be called. He was called, spoke to him on the phone, told him that we are not leaving, and he had some not nice things to say, including encouraging us to rethink. In any case, we spent most of the rest of that night, continuing to talk about these issues. I spent a good chunk of that time talking with one particular young man, one of the local people, and so everybody fell asleep at one point or another, or didn't sleep, stayed up the whole night. The next morning, Shabbos morning, so I was able to get up to a corner and daven. Around 11 o'clock in the morning, the officer walked into the room and he said that he had a message from Chief of Police Wilson. The message was that they decided not to book us because Selma was so flooded with television stations and media people and newspapers from all over the world that they felt that it would be an embarrassment to Selma for all of the media to discover that they were booking some 50 clergy. They were not embarrassed about booking blacks, so not even so much about that they would be booking 50 clergy. And that therefore they were going to be releasing us, but that they felt that it was would not be safe for us to walk through the white neighborhoods to get back to Brown's Chapel, and that therefore they were going to have buses lined up in front of the courthouse, and that they would load us into the buses and it would take us back to Brown's Chapel. So I was still sort of sitting on the floor next to this young black man with whom I had spent most of the night talking, and I said to him, it's my Shabbat, and I don't think I'm going to get out on the bus. There's no reason for me to ride on the bus, and I can walk back to Brown's Chapel. So he said, "No, you're crazy, and it's really going to be dangerous for you to do that." And I said, "I don't think so. I mean, I've been out in the white neighborhood a lot, actually, between these various trips to different places, and I think I know my way around. I know which bars to avoid, I'm pretty confident that I'll be okay. So, when you guys get on the bus, I'll just start walking back."
So he said, you're crazy, you better change your mind. In any case, we sort of got separated at that point when everybody was trying to pull their whatever stuff they had together to get ready to leave. It took about 45 minutes till the buses arrived, and then an officer came in and announced that everybody should sort of line up at the exit. And so everybody was lining up in the room and started out the exit of the room that we were in towards the main exit of the building, through the hallways to the main exit of the building, got to the main exit of the building, and there at the main exit of the building, the line stopped. And the people in the front of the line were told by the police officers to keep going, go down the street, stop loading on the buses, and they said, no, we're not going on the buses. They said, there's a rabbi here, it's his Sabbath, and he doesn't ride on the Sabbath, and we're not going to leave him alone. We're not going to leave him alone to go walking from here to Brown's Chapel, so we're all going to walk with him. So that set off quite a stir amongst the police officers, and they called the chief of police in on it, and everything else, and they screamed, and they were screaming and threats, and how this sort of evolved without my knowledge in the group, I to this day don't quite understand, but it did, and the group sort of held to its own and said they were not going to get on the buses, they were not going to leave me behind. So I mentioned before that the police in Selma and even the state police have worked very hard to keep the white residential neighborhoods quiet. No demonstrations, right? No noise. And suddenly on that Shabbat around noontime, through the entire white neighborhood, there was a march of approximately 250 Knicks, whites, blacks, clearly Jews, non-Jews, walking through the streets, on one side accompanied by a phalanx of buses, on the other side accompanied by a line of police officers, because they meant it when they said that it would not be safe for us to walk through the neighborhoods. They knew what they were talking about. And at that point, we walked through the entire neighborhood to get back to Brown's Chapel. And to me, that moment was extraordinarily important because it showed just what can evolve in the context of the relationship between people who have a common sense, even though coming from very different places, have a common sense of a desire to achieve a particular kind of goal of justice. And the kind of sense of mutual responsibility that can emerge in that kind of setting.
So, by the time Shabbat was over, we had also found out that Martin Luther King had negotiated a deal with President Johnson for federal protection for the marchers, but that as a result of that, the number of marchers would have to be limited, that there could not be more than a minimum number of marchers, and therefore there were lotteries that were drawn, except for people but the rest of us Indians needed to sort of draw lots, and I did not draw a lot that was low enough of a number to go on the march, but I did participate in the beginning of the march, which started in Selma to the Peter's Bridge, and at the Peter's Bridge, which is sort of the boundary of Selma, there were lineups of federal army officers to protect the marchers, and the marchers continued to march. So I want to make one final comment, and then I'd be glad to take questions.
There's three stories about Moshe. So in the first story, the means that Moshe uses in order to achieve justice, the protection that is necessary, was he used violence. And we have discovered as a people, certainly even before, but certainly since the Holocaust and the birth of Israel, that there are times when the protection of Am Yisrael requires use of violence, and that we have to be ready to use it when it is in fact necessary. In the second story, Moshe doesn't use violence. Moshe uses tochacha, he uses speech. He calls out, he speaks out. Because there are times when injustice can be addressed simply through speaking out, and you don't have to use force of any sort, but you do have to speak out vigorously. And then in the third instance, what does Moshe do to protect the daughters of, to protect the rights of the daughters of Yitro to water their flocks? What does he actually do? So it's strange, the Torah does not tell us what he does. It doesn't describe him as using violence, it doesn't describe him even as raising his voice. It's as if his mere presence there, it's as if his presence there makes a difference. And the reality is that we have discovered that there are times when, in battling for a just cause, all that is needed is to establish one's presence almost as a witness to the injustice, as a means of preventing the performance of the injustice. So hopefully most of us will never need to use violence in order to achieve justice. If it's needed, then we need to do it. But certainly we need to be ready to raise our voices against injustice. And we need to be ready, certainly, to make our presence known, to indicate our support for causes that are just, to prevent others from being mistreated, to prevent others from having been deprived of their rights.
So there is much more that I could tell you, but I would rather at this point to bring my presentation to a close and take at least a few minutes to answer questions. So thank you all very much. And those of you who have to leave, you're welcome to leave. Questions? Yeah, you want to stand?
Sure. I was surprised to learn today that someone who did for civil rights what you did in 1965, just 3 years later, when you were the rabbi of Brookline, became a member of the JDL. And I'm wondering if that was a change in philosophy or if you could explain that.
Okay, it's a fair question. It is not that I hardly ever talk to him. I don't know who was, who recalled that. But, so let me tell you what happened. I became the rabbi after I left Berkeley. My wife and dad at Berkeley in 1969. Moved back to Boston, the opportunity to be close to our Soviet and to be within a larger Orthodox community was very exciting for us. I became the rabbi again in Israel at Brookline. About 6 months into my rabbi again in Israel at Brookline, there were a number of young men who came to visit me. And what they wanted to talk to me about was that they were planning to start a chapter of the Jewish Defense League in Boston. And they wanted to know whether I would be willing to support them. So I told them that they are obviously free to start a chapter of JDL in Boston, but if they choose to do so, that I would condemn them from the pulpit. Because I said, the level of unnecessary violence that had been manifested in those immediately preceding years while JDL was under the leadership of Americana, while the JDL was under his leadership, there had been numerous instances, both in terms of those who recall, I mean, the bombing in the Russian travel office, which killed somebody, and then the violence that was taking place in
demonstrations on that. So they truly were just way excessive. They were simply not, I believe, at that point in time, were not only not necessary, they were counterproductive. And they resulted in death and injury to people who were innocent people. And that therefore, if they want to start a chapter of JBL, as I said in Boston, I will condemn them. So they were taken aback by my vigorous opposition. They came back 2 weeks later. And they said they weren't going to meet with me again, so I met with them a second time. And they said, are there conditions under which you could support us? So I said, yes, there are conditions. I've been thinking about this, obviously. Yes, there are conditions under which I can support this, because I think that some of the stuff that JDL has done, such as the creation of community patrols and some of the demonstrations of Soviet Jewry and educating the community in Soviet Jewry, are vitally important. And it's good stuff. So what I would be willing to support is the following. I would be willing to support a JDL chapter that was committed to no violence, that would engage in only 2 areas of activity. 1, education and protest demonstrations on behalf of Soviet Jewry, in which there would be no violence. And secondly, since Dorchester and Mattapan were then emptying, leaving behind significant numbers of elderly Jews who were becoming seriously in danger, I said it's vitally important for us living in the safety of Brookline and Newton to organize community patrols in conjunction with the black community, because the black community in Dorchester and Mattapan are the ones who suffer most from the violence that is taking place in the community, and that what we need to do is organize together with the black ministers in Dorchester and Mattapan, organized community patrols in close cooperation with the police, with no weapons, only in close communication with the police. So I said, if those conditions would be met, then since nobody else seems willing to explore this event, nobody else seemed willing to undertake either of those projects in a really significant way, that I would be willing to see that happen through JBL. So they went off. They said they would think about it. They went off, and they came back again to see me about a week later, and they said as follows. They said, Mayor Kahana is vehemently opposed to our accepting your conditions, but we don't see any other way that we're going to be able to work in this community, and we think these purposes are very important. So we're willing to create the JDL chapter in Boston under those conditions. But they said they wanted one thing in turn from me, and that is that I should agree to serve on the steering committee of the JDL chapter in Boston. So I decided that I would do that. And we, in fact, created community patrols in collaboration with the black clergy in Dorchester and Mattapan. The police were thrilled because we were going to be unarmed. What I did agree to a few months later was that at least one of the patrol groups could use a dog, trained defense dog, but no weapons, but the police would keep a line open so that if any call came from one of these patrols, they would be there within minutes. And we set that up, and it stayed on for, we were in Boston only for 2 years, and during that year and a half,
that remain, those were
was a very important instrument for protecting both Jews and blacks in Dorchester. That plan was extremely effective. Mayor Kahn remained furious about it. The next year, the National Convention of JDL took place in Boston, and Mayor Kahn came to our home, and he let me have it. I mean, he told me that what I'm doing is absolutely wrong, and that, you know, if you don't train Jews to be directly self-defense, you don't train them to use guns and to be ready to use them, then you're never going to be prepared for whatever we're going to be doing. I mean, it was an intense kind of controversy. But, you know, the local chapter held to its commitments on this. So during the rest of that period of time, I remained, very close working with them. Also in relation to Soviet Jewry, we did many protests and we did very extensive education related to Soviet Jewry. One particular event was really interesting, and that is someone had noted that there was a Russian trawler that was scheduled to arrive in Boston Harbor. And so we developed a plan to leaflet the Russian trawler from a plane, to drop leaflets onto the Russian trawler calling for the liberation of Soviet Jewry. Right? And this was 1970. Right? This was prior to the First World Conference on Soviet Jewry, which I attended in Brussels. One of the greatest moments of Chilul Hashem in the history of the Jewish people. In any case, and we developed this plan. There were only three of us involved in the planning, myself and the two chairs of the JDL chapter. We did all the planning in sort of in personal conversation and over phone lines, and we hired a plane, found a pilot who was willing to do this, and then one afternoon I was home and the phone in our house rang and I picked up the phone and a man identified himself, said, "I'm so and so from the FBI, and can I have a conversation with you?" So I said, "Sure, you know, be glad to make an appointment." So he said, "Well, my colleague and I happen to be right at the corner. Do you mind if we come over right now?" So I said, "Sure, you know, you come over." So I hung up the phone, and I quickly called the attorney who represented the JDL, and with whom we consulted about all, you know, legal matters. And I told him about this call. So he said, "Yeah, you definitely did the right thing." He said, "But what I would suggest is you have a tape recorder in the house." He said, "Set up the tape recorder somewhere where the conversation can be recorded, because they will definitely be recording the conversation. You'll notice," he said, "that at least one of them will keep this code with him, because they'll be a tape recorder in it, and they will shape the tape in any way that they want. So you can't depend on its emerging as anything similar to what you actually said. And don't tell them anything, don't confirm anything. So hear them out and, you know, discuss it with them." So that's what we did. You know, moments later the front door rang. Well, you know, Shelby set up a tape recorder behind the door to my study. One of these doors are flat, so the sound would go through. And I welcomed them into the house, I offered to take their coats. One of them said, "No thanks, it's all right, I'll get the couch." And we then sat around on the couch and they said, "We need you to call off that plan." So I said, what plan? And they said, "The plan is new for the controller." So I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." They said, "Well, we know that you know what we're talking about, so let's just be straight about this. The State Department believes that this has the possibility of resulting in an international incident of great significance, and they're not willing to take that risk. You need to call this off." So I said, "I don't know what you're talking about, but how could, you know, dropping it, talking about dropping leaflets
How did that create an international incident? They said, so who says that someone on the Russian patrol will take out a gun and shoot at the plane and bring it down? Right? And then what's going to happen? So I said, listen, in any case, it was a lengthy conversation, and I did what the lawyer advised me to do, and did not, fess up to anything, but it was clear that, so from that moment on, whenever, Shelly would answer the phone in the house, she would say, hi, who is this? And then, particularly if she was sharing recipes with friends, she would say, and whoever else is listening, you want a great recipe. but the reality was that, we did not change the plan. 2 days later, the pilot called us and told us that he had been fired. Because his boss told him that he doesn't know what's going on in his life, but he's suddenly a national risk. So we managed to find another pilot in a different state who agreed that he would undertake this particular trip. And then a few days after that, in the Boston Globe, when they were reporting the news, there was a report that a planned visit by a Russian troller had been canceled. There were numbers of things that the JDL chapter did, but all of it was in accordance with those guidelines. And as long as that was the case, while I was not thrilled about the idea that I was associated with some of the stuff that others did in JDL, it seemed to me at that point in time that that was the most effective way of achieving those particular purposes. So that's what I did. All right, any other questions? Yeah.
Comments on today's relationship, today's politics with minorities and the Jewish community?
But look, everybody knows that the alliance between the Jewish community and the question was, when I comment on the current sort of relationship between the Jewish community and minorities. So everybody knows that the relationship between the Jewish and the Black communities, which had begun to fray already in the mid-60s, by the early 70s, particularly because of stuff that was happening here in New York area, but particularly in New York City, that relationship had begun to fray very seriously and essentially collapse. Part of that had to do with the absence of Reverend King, right? That is, when Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968, he was a cement. Powerful cement between the Jewish community and the Black community, because the Jewish community trusted him. So why did the Jewish community trust him? Basically trust him. It doesn't mean that the Jewish community agreed with everything that he said or did. But there were elements of his positions that the Jewish community was very much appreciative of. And it's like, the Jewish community has learned over the course of time that you don't believe someone just because they say something. You really want to find out to whom someone says something, right? So when Arafat and Bashimo would talk about, the great desire of the Palestinians for peace, right, when he was speaking English, we learned that that doesn't mean very much. You have to listen to what he was saying in Arabic, right? And what he was saying in Arabic tended to be a much more honest reflection of his inner feelings, right? But the truth of the matter is so you have to listen to what people are saying. Martin Luther King already in the early 60s, before the majority of establishment organizations here in the United States were supportive of public demonstrations for Soviet Jewry. Remember, that was a significant battle. That's what I was referring to earlier in terms of the 1970 World Conference of Soviet Jewry, where the world organizations, including the State of Israel, refused to create a separate organization to pursue the freedom of Soviet Jewry because they were all concerned about where the money was going to go. You'll excuse me for saying that.
I was there, and that's why I experienced. In any case, already in 1963, Martin Luther King was telling black churches, when there were no Jews around, was telling them that as long as my brethren in the Soviet Union, my Jewish brethren in the Soviet Union, are not free to practice their religion, I am not fully free here in America. And even before the war of 1967, Martin Luther King was telling Jews and was telling blacks that when you hear someone being anti-Zionist, look closely. Because he said, most of the anti-Zionism that's out there is anti-Semitism. Not all of it. There can be honest anti-Zionism out there, but a lot of that anti-Zionism is really anti-Semitism. And so you have to know where the anti-Zionism is coming from. And sort of what's in the heart of those people. And long before Jews were thinking that way seriously, right? And he was talking that way to his own community when there were no Jews around. And not that much likelihood of that of other kinds of stuff getting out. That doesn't mean that he agreed with the Jewish community over every issue. And it doesn't mean that he agreed with everything that Israel did. And it doesn't mean that we have to become apologists for some other positions that he took or didn't take. But there was a fundamental sense of trust that existed between Martin Luther King and the leadership of the American Jewish community. And when he was assassinated, and leadership of the black community fell into the hands of people more radically oriented, but also more oriented toward something else. And this, let me talk to this for a minute, and then I'll stop and say anything. You know, we're reading these parashiyot in the Torah, and we're about to read about all of these, right, the Exodus itself, right? And then, right, as soon as they get out into the Midbar, after all of the miracles of the, right, the Makot and of Kriyat Yom Suf, right? Right after that, they're already complaining, right? They're complaining there's no water, they're complaining there's no bread, they're complaining there's no meat, they're complaining there's everything, right? I mean, what's going on here? Right? Like, where's their Emunah? Right? So it's a really serious question. The Midrash has a consistent answer to that question. The Midrash has a fascinatingly consistent answer to that question. The Midrash, at least in one tract of the Midrash, not a uniform approach of the Midrash, but there is one particular tract of Midrash that has a uniform answer to that question. Every time the Jews say, what are you doing here? Why did you take us out of Mitzrayim? Why did you take us out of Mitzrayim to kill us in the desert? Every time the Jews say that, the Midrash says, it was not the Jews. It was the Arabah. It was the Arabah. It was the Arabah who complained about the absence of water, the Arabah who had some bread, the Arabah. It was the Arabah who led the, you know, the making of the golden calf, right? All the fault of the Arabah. It's not us, Chas V'Shalom, right? We didn't do anything, right? We are responsible for our own redemption, but we are not responsible for any of the faults that happened over the course of that process of redemption. So we own the redemption. We own the redemption. These other people, they don't own the redemption because they were part of the barriers to the redemption. They were part of the problem, not part of the solution. We own the redemption. It's ours. Only ours. Nobody else's. Right? So that attitude, is a very powerful attitude in some circles of black leadership. It became evident already in the 1960s. I mean, even when we were in Berkeley, there were, you know, some circles who had that kind of attitude. It became more powerful in the 70s and 80s, and it remains powerful to this day. That is, that the community, black community, for many people in the black community needs to own its own redemption. And anybody else who is perceived as helping is probably only creating problems. I think that that's what fed into even the movie, right? You know, those of you who saw the movie Selma, right? And even, you know, unfortunately, Susanna Heschel even complained about the fact that Rabbi Heschel was replaced in the front line of the march, right, replaced with a Greek Orthodox priest who was not seen in the actual photographs. He may have been there, but he was not seen in the actual photographs of the march. But Heschel was gone. There was one guy two or three rows back who seemed to have a kippah on his head. There was certainly no indication in the whole of the movie that there was any Jewish help in this process, right? But for that matter, even look at the treatment of Johnson. Right? I mean, Johnson was made into a reluctant dragon. President Johnson was made into a reluctant dragon. Whether it was or was not, I don't know, I'm not close enough to the situation. But certainly, there are lots of people who were very close to President Johnson who maintained that that was a misrepresentation of President Johnson. That he was really honestly and fully committed to, you know, to the gaining of civil rights for blacks. I don't know whether that was true or not. But what I do know is that the orientation of the movie was, we own this. The black community owns this. Whatever it was that we achieved through Selma and in Selma was because of our efforts. And what you were, the guys, you were reluctant dragons. Maybe you were there, maybe you were not there, but it doesn't matter. Right? That sense of pride, of ownership, of redemption, is something that we ought to at least understand is not unique for an oppressed people. Not unique to blacks in America. Because we felt the same way about our redemption, right, centuries and centuries ago. And it's a kind of natural human feeling to need to own it. Just the need to own it. So, I don't think that we'd be able to complain too much about that. The fact is that the rise of black pride in the early to mid-1960s had an enormous Jewish impact. Right? I mean, those of you who may remember that, I mean, when I was a graduate student at NYU Law School, there were eight firm men, there were a couple of firm women, there were eight firm men in the law school, NYU Law School at that time, in my evening class, right? There were eight from men, and they were from all different yeshivot and different places. There was only one who wore kippah all the time. Only one. When I was on campus at Berkeley, right, there were 24,000 students at the University of California at Berkeley, of whom a significant percentage were Jewish, and a significant handful were observant. I was the only person who wore a kippah on campus. That was in 1963 to 1967. We spent the year 67-68, my Michelle and I spent the year 67-68 in Israel, which was planned before the war, not a consequence of the war, but we arrived in Israel in July of 1967. We were there for the following year until June of 1968, the day that we were coming back. We were in the London airport when news came through of Bobby Kennedy's assassination. Right? We got back in 1968, there were dozens of kippot. And when we stopped off in New York on our way, somebody saw huge numbers of kippot. Right? Why? Why? Because we discovered a sense of Jewish pride in the events that took place in the war of 1967 that made us sort of come out from hiding and reassert with a sense of real pride who we are. And that when that happens to an oppressed people, you have to respect that. You can't make fun of it, and you can't view it as an attack on the rest of the world. That kind of particularism, which is reflective of a sense of cultural pride, is not an attack on the rest of the world. It's just an affirmation of one's own community. And we should not view that as an attack on the rest of us. I say the same thing about the whole issue of black pride related to Black Lives Matter. When blacks say Black Lives Matter, they're not saying nobody else's life matters.
It's like when we say never again, what do we have in mind, never again? Who are we thinking of when we say never again? We think never again that they're going to kill Jews in the streets. Right, when Mayor Kahana started talking that way, that's what he was talking about, and to this day, that's what we really mean. But when we say that Jews have to defend themselves, that doesn't mean that nobody else has to defend themselves. And when we say that Jews have to have a sense of pride in who we are and what we represent, it doesn't mean that that's a negation of the value of anybody else in this world, a negation of anybody else's culture, anybody else's truths or whatever. Just means that we have a sense of responsibility that's important, that we have to be bearers of. And that's beneficial to the black community. It's not detrimental to them. And we should not misread that as if it was an attack on the white world. And I was in St. Louis in the early stages of the rise of the Black Lives Matter stuff. And there were people in this particular, it was a Philadelphia convention, Hill conference that was taking place. And people started saying, no, all lives matter. We should just say all lives matter. All lives matter. Well, yeah, it's true, all lives matter. But that doesn't mean that someone saying that Jewish lives matter is saying that no lives matter. And it doesn't mean that when blacks say blacks' lives matter, that they say nobody else's life matters, and that police can go ahead, or anybody can go ahead and kill anybody. But except blacks, just doesn't mean that. And so we have to not misread those kinds of cultural expressions. From my perspective, it would be very important for there to be a restoration of the alliance between, between Jews and blacks. We tend to get driven off by this whole pattern that was developed, in which everybody has to accept everybody else's truth. So that's a whole other matter. All right, one last question, and then we have to stop. Yes.
I'm so impressed that you're an Orthodox rabbi and you do all this, and you're on the right side of history. You mentioned Israel. I'm not a Zionist. However, I support the people of Israel, not this particular government. How do you think the direction of Israel and America's government, especially voting rights and suffrage sessions, is going, as opposed to the direction that Yitzhak Rabin was trying to take it? He didn't get there. He was also
I appreciate the question. Yeah. I'd be glad to discuss it with you privately. It's a too big a conversation for us to get into right now. It's both late at night, and it's such a complicated and divisive issue that it should not be confused with sort of the issues that we've been discussing so far tonight. Okay? So thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi
Scott. Thank you. I was reading my 5-year-old story about his name is Mozart, it doesn't matter. Not about Mozart, it's 7:45 on the page where it said Michael Mozart. I remember Michael Mozart from Warsaw.
Oh my God.
So I got here in time.
Okay, good.